Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Providing insight and resources for your spiritual journey. Unity Online Radio. Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Today, I welcome back to the show Brian Leaf. He's the author of Misadventures of a Garden State Yogi, as well as 12 other books. His latest book is entitled The Teacher Appears. It's a little different. It's a Zen-like book of inspirations and calls to journal and contemplate. It's 108 prompts, actually, to power your yoga practice. And although that yoga practice may be traditional yoga in the sense asanas or whatever, it's also for the yogi in all of us, that the yearner for spiritual understanding and connection to the divine. So it's 108 prompts to power your practice as a spiritual being, I think, as well. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Brian Leaf back to the show. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks so much. Good to be back. We worked hard to make this happen.
We did. There were many misadventures on the way to the World Spirituality Show, but we're here. So, yeah. And it is a different kind of book, isn't it, to what you normally write?
Yeah, it was really a lot of fun to do. You know, a lot of things kind of colluded and evolved to become that book. I was writing a book about intuition. I was writing a book about tapping into intuition, and which is really one of the guiding principles in my life. I feel like, and when I say intuition, it's not like psychic type stuff, although there's nothing wrong with that. That's great. But to me, it's like reclaiming that wisdom that's inside the human body and the human being, like the connection to spirit or wisdom or knowing, some sort of like Jungian superconscious. I don't really know. It's connecting to that knowing that we all have that a lot of folks in our culture, it's pretty easy to get disconnected from it. I've spent 20 or 30 years really trying to reconnect it and also to facilitate other folks to reconnect. So anyway, I was writing a book about intuition, and my editor said, that's great, but I don't think there's a lot of people Googling or going to Amazon and searching for intuition, so I don't know. So then I realized, like, to me, that's really what yoga practice is, beyond the physical and, looking good and stretching. Getting trim, to me, yoga is really about tuning in, and as it should be, I think, it's about tuning into that inner wisdom, tuning into the piece of us that participates in God, And so I thought, I'll shift the book a little bit towards yoga, and then he said, well, yeah, that's what people are looking for. And then I thought, I want to give people an experience of that. I don't want to just write about it this time. I've done that. I want to try to give them an experience, bring them into it. And that's kind of what brought out this book, which is, it's kind of like an illustrated journal. It aims to give people an experience.
Yes, I like that. And I think you're absolutely right about intuition. On a recent show, I was with Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., and he was talking about how we have to learn to unlearn. And I think the Sufis talk about that, too. It's, we have an overlay of discursive thought and intellectuality, you know, and we have to sort of move that out of the way so we can return to that state of knowing, of deep inner knowing, that's our natural inheritance. That's the way we'd look at it in unity, at least. And nothing wrong with thought, nothing wrong with maneuvering our way around, you know, the world using our brains, but there's more going on, right? There's that meta function, if you like, that higher awareness that we can tap into. And, you know, some people are so afraid of allowing it to happen for themselves that they, like you say, seek out, you know, psychics or experts who'll tell them how to be intuitive. And that's okay, I guess. But, you know, ultimately, it's something that is within ourselves, right? We're releasing that knowledge directly. It's not about getting it from somebody else.
Yeah, that seems to be sort of my life's work, really, like to cultivate that for myself and then also therefore to teach and write about that with and facilitate other folks. Because, yeah, I really do believe that there's a knowing inside us, and there's so many different, you know, kind of ways that people have explored it, and so much different language for it. There's, you know, following your bliss from Joseph Campbell, and there's a lot of different ways people have approached it, and I like them all. You know, anything that brings people into the felt sense, into the sense of their heart, that knowing. And there are certain places where it's been, it's like, or encouraged in our culture. It's encouraged in falling in love. You know, like, people are, in our culture, you know, you have this experience, which is very metaphysical, really. I mean, it's very intangible. You know, I would say it probably eludes scientific explanation at this point. You know, there's that feeling of the whole room goes black and white, and suddenly this one person's in color, and you're in love or lust or something. And that kind of felt sense, that kind of knowing, I think can influence and permeate everything else, too.
Of course, we have to be careful, don't we, when we're talking about things like falling in love. You know, like you said, is it really falling in love, or is it falling in lust? And, you know, a lot of the biochemical processes of our bodies kind of take over, and we feel like, oh my gosh, I'm in touch with something larger. But it may not necessarily be, you know, direct intuition from larger awareness. It may be, you know, all those various components that go to make us attracted to another person. Nothing wrong with that, but we can wake up from that sometimes and realize we've been a bit of a fool. It's a bit like Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, who's converted into a donkey or an ass and he falls in love with Titania and then realizes, oh my goodness, you know, what a fool I've been, and what a fool she'd been, too, because she fell in love with him as an ass, you know, because the magic potion was
It's a great point. It's a great point. And that's why I guess this process, like so many other processes, is a training. It's a practice. You know, it's not an on-off switch. I mean, like I said, I've literally spent 20 or 30 years working on it. It really is like a, you know, it's a practice. It's like building a muscle that has become a little flaccid. You know, it's like working on a skill that has been a little bit atrophied and ignored. And you're right. I mean, in fact, I would say there's another reason for, you know, I love to look at the pragmatic reasons for the Ten Commandments or the yamas and niyamas in yoga or the precepts in Buddhism. You know, these are not just laws laid out by God. I mean, they are. But beyond that, there are really good reasons for them in the, you know, in walking the razor's edge of spiritual practice and of growth and of unity, you know, seeking unity and connection, there's a lot of pitfalls. And so these kind of practices of, you know, moderation or not lying or not doing things that harm people, they give us the extra energy we need to see clearly. I mean, I know if I drink a little too much at night, nothing wrong with that maybe, but the next day my practice is going to be a little duller usually. You know, once in a while, maybe it serves as a, you know, as an expander, but mostly it's going to leave me a little less able to see clearly the next day.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, just because I sort of drew a comparison there with, you know, our foolishness doesn't mean that it's wrong, actually, because, you know, the Bible talks about this, too, you know, that the foolishness of God is wiser than the the wisdom of man, you know, as St. Paul says. And so, you know, you have to be foolish sometimes. There's lots of wise fools, for instance, in Shakespeare and in history in general, right? It's the first card in the tarot deck is the fool, right? We're on the fool's journey. We have to have the courage to step over off the cliff, if you like, you know, in order to enter this realm. And as long as we, you know, only do the safe thing, we'll never expand. So it's okay to make ourselves a little foolish, I think. You begin the book with a picture.
That's a really good point, because, I mean, fear of being foolishness would lead directly to a lack of vulnerability, which would absolutely be an occlusion towards growth and change. So I totally agree with you. Absolutely. In fact, some of the prompts in the book are really aimed at that in a way. Aimed at, you know, I don't know, there's a way in, do you know, like in crisis, so I can't remember if, and the first time I had to reschedule with you, I don't remember what the issue was, but it might have been, you might recall that about 2.5 months ago, there was a fire in my home.
Yes.
And, you know, and it really, it's, I mean, of course, you can only imagine. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. Nobody was home. My kids didn't have to run out of a burning building, you know, so that was a blessing, and I have so much gratitude. And it's been a crazy road, and it's been a big shakeup. And, of course, as you can well imagine, it's been a massive spiritual teacher. And one of them was that after the fire, we were just so raw. We were so vulnerable. I mean, we walked away with nothing, just the shirts on our backs, and stayed at some friends' houses. And we really had to open ourselves to the kindness of others, which was a beautiful practice because, and you know, crisis of any kind does that. I remember in college even, just a normal fire drill. You know that feeling, maybe you're standing outside a dorm or an apartment building at 2 a.m, and everybody's in their pajamas or whatever, and everybody's just a little bit vulnerable, foolish, and unhinged. And as a result, everybody is just closer. You know, there's the ways in which people, out of fear, we all hold ourselves back. A lot of those layers were just naturally let go, and it was kind of beautiful. And the same after the fire. You know, people really opened up to helping us, which was beautiful. And then it was actually a hard practice to just really relax and receive and just be vulnerable. It was great. And ironically, that is what a lot of the book aims at, is, you know, facilitating that kind of state.
Right. Well, you start with an image of Ganesh, the remover of obstacles, right? And as you say, the patron of letters and learning, God of beginnings, and invite us to color that image. But also, you know, I love Ganesh because Ganesh is not just the remover of obstacles, he's also the placer of obstacles. You know, he creates the obstacles so that he can then remove them. Because it's all part of God's divine order, you know. So even the worst things that happen to us, for instance, the fire, come as a blessing, you know, because within that there's this gift. Though we don't want to jump to conclusions too quickly about that, especially since, you know, recently we've had these terrible fires around the world where, you know, buildings have burned and many people have died inside, and forest fires in Portugal, whatever. So, you know, it's not always as neat and tidy, is it, as that? You know, there can be terrible tragedies too.
Oh, gosh. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, I guess that's the thing, is it's hard to be a human being. And so I think that the brain and humans in general like to try to get a grip on things really get protective of that grip. And so I feel like, especially in the West, maybe there's this notion of good or bad. You know, fire in your house, bad. And to go to that felt sense, to go to the place of faith and faith in God and something higher and humility in that way, and then just feel each situation and say, you know, because our fire, it's been super difficult. But I do think that it was a transformation. It was, you know, a phoenix kind of thing. You know, it really is transformative. And so it's not just fire, good or bad. It's, here's my experience. I mean, I don't think God doesn't always speak to us in ways that we experience as pleasant. Our growth doesn't always occur in ways that feel in the moment pleasant. And this has been, it's been one of the hardest couple of months for my family. And yet also, I'm clear, definitely a blessing, you know?
Yes, absolutely. On later on in the book, the numbers, the pages aren't numbered, so I'm just paging through it. There's a little cut-out bracelet, or bracelet you can cut out. It says, what is most real? And you say, find some crayons and color in this bracelet, then cut it out, connect the ends with tape, and wear it until it falls off. Every time your eye spots it, ask yourself, what is most real right here, right now? And those are good questions to ask ourselves. In the midst of the good and the bad, you know, the highs and the lows, what's really going on? What is most real at this moment? And it shifts us from the reactions of the games, perhaps, that we might be playing around things, the conditioned responses to, you know, events or people, to, you know, let's get real here. What's really going on? And it could be a startling wake-up call, can't it, when we say, maybe I don't need to be spending my time, you know, playing games or reacting. I can actually respond to what is actually present rather than my idea of it, you know, my understanding of it. So that could be quite salutary, I think.
Yeah, I love that one. That was that comes from in, you know, all the different prompts. Some of the prompts were contributed by, you know, famous yoga teachers or spiritual teachers or different folks, and some of them just come out of my own practice. And that one comes out of my meditation. I found a number of years ago that this thing would happen where I was meditating, where, you know, I would just say, okay, what is most real right now? And I'd say, okay, I'm really angry. And that would feel, it's like I drop a little deeper. And then I would notice, oh, man, I'm trying to shift, because I'm judging that anger. I'm trying to shift it. I'm not comfortable with it. Then I would drop in a level deeper. And it's like dropping in means, to use yogic terms, I guess you'd say, instead of identifying with the experience or the passing thoughts or the passing feelings, I start to then identify with the truer I, the truer self, the part that is part of the universal, you know, person, the universal God, and tapping into the heart or the true self, the one who, the unflickering candle, you know. And so every time I do that, I drop in a level deeper, and sometimes if I can touch that, if I can say, whoa, I'm feeling really angry, I knew that already, but I'm trying to shift that anger. Suddenly, because I'm identifying with something deeper that sees the anger and sees what I'm trying to do, then there's a shift, and I just feel better. I feel sick, I feel calmer, just more in touch with the felt sense, less reactive. It's super helpful. And actually, I found that in the past few weeks, it's been incredibly helpful in getting me through, you know, and helping me in this changing time.
Yeah, very good. Srinivasagadatta Maharaj, a great Indian teacher, said, beyond being and non-being lies the immensity of the real. And I've always liked that, you know, beyond who we think we are, who we think we're not. Yeah, you know, we can get beyond those things. We can find the real, and I think that is so true. I'm with Brian Leaf. We're talking about his new book, The Teacher Appears, 108 Prompts to Power Your Yoga Practice. When we come back after the break, we'll talk about more elements of the book. So join us then after these messages from Unity.
Wouldn't you like to share the programs that inspire you most with audiences around the world? That's easier than ever with mobile giving. Just text Unity Radio to 72727 and help us continue offering spiritual programs that change lives. Now available, YouPray, the free prayer app from Silent Unity. For more than a century, people from all over the world and all walks of life have turned to Silent Unity. With YouPray, our confidential prayer support is easy and convenient to access. With YouPray, you can send your prayer directly to Silent Unity. YouPray also includes affirmations you can share with family and friends, plus audio meditations for your prayer time. For more about the free YouPray app and links to download, visit silentunity.org/app. That's silentunity.org/app.
The world is full of voices, advertising, television, politics, colleagues, family, and friends. All are too happy to tell us how to live. In all of that noise, it's easy to miss the one voice that matters, your own soul. What would happen if you could hear that voice? Imagine the clarity, confidence, and courage that would be yours and the life you could create. Join Janet Connor, best-selling author of Writing Down Your Soul, The Lotus and the Lily, and Your Soul Wants Five Things, as she and her guests explore how to hear the call of the soul and create the soul-directed life. Live Thursday at 1 p.m. Central, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Go inside to find.
You've been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. I'm with Brian Leaf, and we're talking about his book, about yoga practice. The teacher appears, one of the great teachers of our generation in Buddhism particularly, is Joseph Goldstein. And there's a quote here in the book from him, which really speaks to what we talked about in the first segment. It says, "The erroneous belief that genuine happiness comes only from pleasant feelings can become a strong motivation to stay closed to anything unpleasant. But by staying closed to all unpleasantness, we also stay closed to our own wellspring of compassion." So it's a both-and world, right? We can't have the one without the other. I teach a lot that, terror and beauty are two sides of living. You know, it's the razor's edge, as you said earlier. And we've got to accept the terror if we're to embrace the beauty. And we don't want to do that. You know, we want it to be a nice little safe world. And unfortunately, it isn't, is it?
No. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a beautiful one. He's such a powerful teacher for me. I remember I went to see him speak once here in Northampton, Mass., where I live. And he said something about, you know, I think it was actually years ago. It was during one of the Bush administrations, and somebody was really upset about something that was going on, and asked him, you know, what's your opinion? What do I do? Or something. And he said that in his opinion, or maybe he was quoting a Buddhist text, I'm not sure, there are different planes of existence, and this plane is like the perfect mixture of pain and suffering for. It's like the perfect gymnasium for growth. And he said there are other planes, according to this one belief, that have more pleasure, maybe. But as a result, they're not really as growthful, actually. And this was the perfect place, you know, the perfect balance for that. And I thought that was really interesting. And I've always kind of held on to that because it reminds me that things aren't supposed to be perfect. I haven't messed up. I haven't screwed up when things aren't perfect, you know. Like maybe there's a hard day where my boys are, I've got two kids, and maybe they're being, you know, more needy that day or something, and maybe they're fighting and I'm frustrated. And it does actually help me if I remember, oh yeah, it's not supposed to be perfect. It's not a surrender. It's not a capitulation in any way. It's just like a recognition. I don't know if you do this, but I probably have this, sort of like high bar that I hold myself and the world to. And maybe I meet it and the world meets it like 2% of the time. And the other 98%, I'm like kind of feeling guilty or shameful or angry. And to remember like, oh, it's not supposed to be that perfect, it takes away that guilt, shame, and blame.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I think most of us hold ourselves to some, you know, invisible yardstick of perfection, right, where we could never quite measure up. And we have to really question that, you know, who created the yardstick in the first place, you know, how did it arise, and is it really necessary? I like to think, you know, I'm yeah. It's okay to be messy and juicy, you know, and messy things and juicy things are never perfect, you know, but they they're alive. The body that's alive is fuzzy. The body that's dead is like a sculpture. You know, it's perfect, but it's dead. So it's okay to be fuzzy, I think, a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, you know, for a while before this book, Teacher Appears, I was writing a book, which I didn't wind up finishing and publishing. And I felt like I wasn't on the right path. But I was writing this book about different health things, you know, different health trends and different stuff like that. And I read this great quote that I really loved. It said something like, don't get to the point where you find yourself alone in your kitchen eating raw organic kale and judging your friends.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's like, that, you know, it's just like taking one thing way too far. You know, and it's kind of easy to do. It's easy to go accidentally, you know, get down that road because, I don't know, as soon as we become pretty zealous about something, there is this integration period where we kind of wind up judging everybody by whether or not they eat organic raw kale.
I happen to like kale, but I know a lot of people that would be their worst nightmare is to eat raw organic kale.
No, I do. I like kale. If I haven't had kale in a certain amount of time, I start to really crave it. So I agree with you there, but definitely critical not to judge other folks.
Yeah,
that's a big. Exactly. I think that's a big red flag. You know, when we find ourselves judging other people, that's a red flag that something's out of balance a little bit.
Absolutely. Well, you know, in Christianity, for instance, you know, we've unfortunately thrown out, you know, half of the human psyche and called it the devil, right? And you know, then we become righteous in our one-sidedness, you know, in our holiness or whatever. But really, that's an indicator right there that we have not integrated that other side of us, which we've demonized as the devil. And instead, it's just the dark side. And when we integrate those two together, you know, I think it brings a certain humility and compassion to our hearts, you know, where we don't want to be judging others because we see so clearly our own faults. You know, Jesus said this, didn't he? You know, you're focusing on the little tiny speck in another's eye and you've got a large plank in your own, you know, and he loved hyperbole, but it's a wonderful image that it's so easy to see the minute problems of others, but we make quite easily neglect our own work we have to do on ourselves. You've got a great one here.
Go ahead.
No, yeah, sorry, I don't want to. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I love that quote. I totally, I've always resonated with that. It's so beautiful and it's such a good reminder. But I was also going to say, there's in Northampton, where I live, there's this Tibetan store. They sell, like, you know, Tibetan little statues and fabrics and things. And as soon as you walk into that store, it's super apparent that the various, you know, masks on the wall and the various religious items and stuff in the store, it's not all kind of easy and pleasant and happy. It's there's a lot of anger represented, a lot of frustration, and it's kind of beautiful because it's like you say, it's a reminder to embrace all those parts, you know. Actually, I read this article once about people who are not in the minority, people who are not in the majority in a culture. So let's say I grew up Jewish, right? They feel that it's important, like if there's a Jewish person running for president or something, they're kind of in a way held to a higher standard by the Jewish people, because the last thing we want is for you know, this person who's running for president, turns out they did coke in college or something, and because they're the first person running for president who's Jewish, there's a worry that that's going to look bad on the Jewish people, right? But then there's a really bad flip side to that, which is to hold our leaders to perfection, you know, to not allow them to be juicy in a way or real or vulnerable. It makes a false bar. It makes us feel particularly shameful because each and every one of us knows inside that we're not perfect. And we hold a shame around that. And to release that shame, to realize that, you know, even Da Vinci had, you know, maybe ate too much chocolate at night or whatever, you know, would really free us up to just let loose a little bit and just be a little bit less shamed and a little less guilty. So to see that imperfection, you know, in the Tibetan store, it's really freeing in a way.
Absolutely. Well, and it's so inconsistent too. You know, I remember when Bill Clinton was running for president, and everybody was up in arms the fact that he might have smoked some marijuana, you know, and then hence the famous line, you know, I never inhaled, which is a real silly thing for him to say, I think. But nevertheless, he felt he needed to. But then when, you know, George W. Bush was brought on as president, you know, he immediately said, yeah, I used to do cocaine. You know, I was a drug addict when I was younger or whatever, an alcoholic. And it was like, oh, well, no big deal. You know, that's fine. And I thought, you know, it's a problem for one person, you know, to inhale some marijuana. But, you know, he could be a coke addict and that's fine. So our society is a little strange like that, I think. And I think we're going through this right now with you know, fake news. You know, the person who's accusing everybody else of fake news is the biggest faker of them all. So, you know, it casts on its head the idea that there's any such thing as sanity in our society. Maybe I'm cynical, but it's different rules for one and different for others.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I'm biased, but I clearly part of my path is to meditate. But just today, even before the show, I was thinking, how does anybody get through the day or the year without meditating? To me, it's just very, and it kind of drops. It's so easy to get lost in what we're talking about here, or in the swirl of it all, or knowing, kind of having a center in the tempest. You know. And to me, meditating, it gives me this, like, it allows me to drop in, truly. It gives me, like, an anchor to God, an anchor to universal energy, whatever you want to call it, in this juicy tempest, this juicy, imperfect tempest that is really human existence.
You've got an interesting little exercise here. It says, draw pictures of your mind before and after your next meditation, and I think that's kind of cool because, you know, just to note what comes up from the subconscious before we found that centeredness, hopefully, and then after. And I'm sure those pictures will be quite different. I'm gonna do that exercise myself, I think, because that's lovely.
Nice. Yeah, I love that one. That's really great. There's another one somewhere in there that says, what does it say? Something like, for the next day, or for the rest of today, every time you speak, put your hand on your heart. Uh-huh. And I love that one. You know, it's like, just what would that be like to every time we speak? Because there's a lot of influences on us when we interact with folks: fear, insecurity, anxiety, the jockeying for power. What would it be like to really put my hand on my heart and just kind of speak from that place all day? It'd be pretty amazing, and I wonder, you know, how other folks will respond to come from that. So, of course, it's also kind of funny, you know, because it would be kind of comical to see somebody doing that, but beautiful, too.
And, you know, it's interesting our reactions to people that do the unexpected. You know, there was a recent YouTube series of, I can't remember the guy's name, but I think he's in New York and he's got long curly hair and just does street art, you know, just sings and dances around the place, goes into stores and whatnot, and then speaks a few words of wisdom. But you know, some people love him, and some people, and you know, they want to beat him up, you know, because he's sort of out of the box a little bit. And again, comes back to that fool image earlier. You know, it's we can have very distinct responses, and depending on our mood too, you know, to people who are trying to present something out of the ordinary, right? It can be confrontive, but it can also be enlightening. You know, depending.
Gosh, yeah, no, that's so true and really interesting. I found when I was living at Kripalu, so the Kripalu Yoga Center in the Berkshires in Western Mass, years ago, and, you know, so many folks there would be studying all kinds of things from shiatsu to, you know, Ayurvedic pulse diagnosis to reading auras, right? And everybody was wanting to practice their stuff. And, sometimes I would get really triggered. Somebody would come up to me and say, you know, I feel that your next relationship is going to be, you know, something, something, something. And yeah, sometimes it was just super enlightening and enlivening. And other times you really get this, I would get this real guttural response, like you want to punch them or you just want to cry.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah. I started actually protecting myself a little bit. I'd say, oh, you know, I don't want to read my, you know, joints to tell me if I'm eating too much baked goods. Like, I don't want that right now. You know?
Yeah, right.
So, but that is the thing. I actually, the other day, my son, it loves rocks. He loves crystals and collecting them. And we had been to a tag sale after the fire, right? We had to replace some stuff. We went to this tag sale, and it was amazing. He found this rock collection that some teenager was done with and wanting to move on. And so my son bought it, and it was so beautiful and great. And we bought it to this crystal store for the guy to, for whoever worked there to tell my son about the different crystals. And it was a real trippy place, you know, really tons of crystals and this real high-energy vibe and this real hippie-ish guy. And he's telling him about the crystals, you know, this is jasper, this is quartz, this is amethyst. And all of a sudden he looks at me and he says, or I said something, which kind of invited it in a way. He could tell that I was open, I guess. And he said, well, you have a very heavy heart, but you have courage and you'll get through. And it was beautiful. It really touched me because it was after the fire, and I really did. I was so sad, and it took me off guard because I hadn't been feeling like that for a little while, I guess, or on and off. And I didn't expect it of myself. You know, I have a pretty high bar. I think to myself, well, I write about yoga. I'm a yoga author. I know what's going on. I've got my stuff together, you know. And I really was really low, and I didn't even fully see it. And when he pointed it out, took a lot of courage for him, you know. I could even tell afterwards, he was like, whoa, sorry about that. You know, it was like an Harry Potter or something when something came through him, you know. And I got to say, it helped me shift because he spoke the truth. And as soon as it's like in meditation, but meditation hadn't shown it to me yet. You know, as soon as I saw it and I identified, oh, wow, I've been really sad. My heart is really, he's so right. Feels like there's a big wet blanket on my heart. And it just seeing that, something about naming it, it really did help shift it. And I was right back to him actually a week later, and I told him how grateful I was. And he said, yeah, I'm glad it went that way because I was a little worried after I said it, you know?
Yeah. I found that that happens a lot in India, for instance. You know, the veil between this world and the spiritual world seems very thin, and there's more integration in India. And I have many events where people come up to me and said things to me, or just looked at me a certain way, you know, and shaken me out of myself into another awareness. And I think we don't always allow that in our society. You know, we kind of shut down a little bit to those realms. So when somebody does do that for us, it can be quite startling, but effective sometimes.
Yeah, that's interesting. A friend of mine leads trips to India, and he really craves being there as much as possible. And what you just said is exactly the reason. You know, he talks about that. He really longs for connection with the divine. You know, he really longs for a devout kind of faith-based life. And he talks about how it's a little harder here. You know, I don't know. I always think it's interesting. You know, we live inside a certain norm, a cultural norm, and it's so difficult to see outside that norm, you know, whether it's the educational system or the political system or the economic system or the faith system. And there's a particular system for each of those at any given time. It's super hard to see outside of it. I mean, I was thinking recently that we probably live, it seems normal to us, but I bet this is like a blip in history. It's probably the only time and place in history where, I don't know, let's say praying to God or your ancestors before making a decision would seem foolish here now to a lot of people. And I bet this is the only time and place in history where praying to God or praying to ancestors would seem strange. That would seem like a given. It would seem totally normal. It would seem crazy not to, I bet, almost any other time in history.
Yes, yeah, you're probably right. It comes from that, you know, sense of super rationalism, I guess. You know, the idea that all that stuff is mumbo jumbo or mysticism or whatever, and we've thrown out a whole lot of babies with the bathwater in the process. I think I've been musing a lot about as a minister. You know, I deal with it quite a bit. That's end of life issues. And how we treat people who are transitioning. And done some shows on it recently. But also, my uncle passed away in Wales, and I had to go back because I was the executor of his estate and still busy working on that. But I got to experience him again because we were estranged. And even though he was dead, I felt he was very much alive. And I'm going through all his personal papers and finding all his journals and dealing with everything in his apartment. Brought him alive again to me. And he was very influential when I was young. But it was a wonderful thing, and it speaks to what you're just saying, and that is that, our ancestors or our loved ones who have passed on, you know, can be very, very much alive. But just because they're dead in their bodies doesn't mean they're dead on other levels. And so it was very powerful, actually, very palpable, this idea of being reacquainted with him, not through his physical sense, but through his life unfolding before me as I was examining all the evidence of his life in the last 20 years, you know, which I've been cut off from. So that was quite fascinating.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. You know, you were saying before about rationalism. I guess it's kind of like we talked about earlier. Rationalism is really an attempt to get a grip on things that we may not have the tools in this plane, you know, in this human body, to get in this human brain. We may not have the tools to really fully get a grip on some of these things, and that's where we have to release to faith. And faith is scary because once in a while people or the church, some church or some organization takes advantage of faith, or, you know, it's juicy, it gets messy, and sometimes the messiness is real messy. And I think the ultra-rationalism is a sense of really get a grip on it, try and understand it. I get very triggered, actually, personally, and I'm sort of in the minority in this way, but I get very, very triggered when people quote, like, science as a hard and fast, absolute explanation for something, you know? Somebody recently told me that one school system, one pedagogy versus another, was backed up by 30 years of neuroscience, and I just think there's a real ignorance or arrogance in assuming that the studies have explained it all, you know. It's my own bias, I suppose, because to me, checking into the heart is more. And you know, like in the ultra-rationalism, I think there can be a sense of until we understand why, we can't really accept that it's true. There's a limitation to that, although there's also a safety in it.
Yes, there's definitely safety in it, I think, but you know, at what cost? That's the tragedy.
There's a page in the book actually that I really like. It's sort of a color in. It says faith is an act of great will, practiced constantly, and I like that one because it speaks to something we talked about much earlier about intuition, foolishness, the potential foolishness of losing ourselves in that. It really is a practice. I mean, we don't. You know, if I could just turn on faith right now and be 100% faithful and ask, you know, for guidance and look to my altar and follow it blindly, I would like that. But it's hard. It's challenging. I find it's literally everyday practice, no different than bench pressing to build the pec muscles. You know, it's like the same
thing. Yeah. There we go. You have a great quote, of course, from the famous quote from the Upanishads, where it says, "You are what your deepest desire is. As your desire is, so is your intention. As your intention is, so is your will. As your will is, so is your deed. And as your deed is, so is your destiny." So everything arises from that deepest desire within us, right? And if your deepest desire is of this world, then you're going to reap a worldly crop. And if your deepest desire is to expand our spiritual awareness, then our destiny becomes that. So the universe will give us where our heart is, right, basically.
Yeah, and there's a lot of responsibility in that. It's amazing. I've been reading, do you ever hear of Florence Scovel Shinn?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I love her. I've been reading her stuff. She was a New Thought minister or a New Thought, you know, teacher in the 1920s, I think. And it's very much about that. You know, it's very much kind of what you reap, you sow. Or, you know, if you're happy for those who have wonderful things, then you get wonderful things. If you wish people success, you get success. And it's it's pretty joyful. It's a pretty wonderful way to live. And it's funny because when I was writing this book, I was really in that space. I would read her every day, like you might read the Bible or any book that you're really in, you know, that really is powerful. And I would read her every day, and it really influenced this. The teacher appears. It influenced my thinking, my feeling. I was just feeling, you know, one of her things is when you pay bills, pay them with joy, you know. And I was doing it, and then the book came out, and it did really well. It was probably my most successful book yet in the launch, and then it started to, you know, peter out a little bit, and I didn't catch it, but I started getting resentful and fearful and angry, like, wait a minute, I did all this stuff right. I was supposed to get $1 million. I'm supposed to get abundance now, and I got mad. You know, I got mad at God. It's like recently I'm worried that my the builder, after the fire, there's a builder who's restoring the house, the insurance company, and I think he lied to me. And so now everything he says, I'm worried he's lying to me, you know? And it's like that with God. It was like, but wait a minute, I did all these things. You lied to me. Where's the money? Where's the ease? Where's the light at the end of the tunnel? And I lost faith for a little bit. And all of a sudden I was meditating or doing something or taking a walk, and I woke up and realized, oh my gosh, I've been depressed and angry because I lost faith. You know, and that's not the way faith works. You know, it's not, transactions with God are not A leads to B always. You know, that's what faith is, right? So then I re-entered faith, and it felt really good. But I was resentful. I was feeling like God had lied.
Well, I think the key to that is, you know, where's our focus? You know, because often our focus begins maybe with an intention to go to the inner, and then we transfer so quickly back to the outer. You know, when we're in the outer, we're in the world of time and change and lies and truths and whatever. It's never perfect, and so we have to recalculate and go back to the inner again, you know, and to find that center. And it's so difficult sometimes to maintain that inner awareness, you know, where there's the flow of abundance. When we get caught up in the shenanigans of the outer, you know, it can throw us off a little bit sometimes.
I find writing books about yoga incredible experience and growth opportunity and challenge in that very regard, because, you know, I'll go really deep inside and just try to really tap my heart and tap my gut and write from that place to create these books. And then, you know, when I'm done creating it, I produce the book, or publisher does, either way, and then it goes out into the marketplace. And at that point, I'm expected to post about it on Facebook and do marketing and speak about it. And that's the part challenging, to stay in touch with the inner, because I'm watching my Amazon ranking, or I'm watching the sales or the money, and it's an exciting challenge, but it's very challenging to stay connected to my truth, to my felt sense, to my intuition, and make decisions from a deep place rather than a place of fear or acculturation or habit or greed or fear, really.
Right. Okay. Later on in the book, you have a Stuart Smalley little. If you remember him from a Saturday Night Live, you know, he invites people to look into the mirror. How do you feel about what you see? Practice yoga and then look at yourself in the mirror again. How do you feel about what you see now? Notice any change in your attitude. And of course, the Stuart Smalley thing is, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and by golly, people love me, or whatever it was. And, you know, they're sort of making a mockery out of this. But really, the truth is, when we can look in the mirror, and everything is a mirror, actually, isn't it? It's everything around us mirrors back who we are at any given time. That can be incredibly powerful if we're willing to look, not with the, you know, the silly platitudes of Stuart Smalley, perhaps, but with total honesty, you know, into the mirror of our lives.
You know, it's so funny that you bring up Stuart Smalley, because I actually almost that quote in the book. And I put that quote in another book that I'm writing. So I have two things I want to say. First of all, whenever I see something like that in the media, there is at first a response of like, oh gosh, we're being made fun of. But then there's a really an appreciation, because something like that really shows that somebody has been, you know, been in the field. They've done some work. They know their stuff, because it's pretty brilliant. That is totally classic. I love that line. And funny enough, it is making fun of it, but it's also so true. If we all did that, it would be so great. but anyway, the mirror one, the reason I thought of that one, I love that one, is because that a lot of these, like I say, they come out of my own practice in one way or another. And I noticed many years ago when I first got into yoga, I noticed that, like, you know, maybe I walk by a mirror and I just, you know, you have these thoughts, right? And I'd walk by a mirror and I'd think, oh, you ugly bastard, you know, you just suck, you know, or something. And, you know, this terrible self-talk. And then I would do yoga. And I remember the first time I noticed this years ago, then I would do my yoga practice. You know, nothing fancy. I mean, just normal American yoga practice. And then, you know, an hour later I walk by the mirror and I would just think, you handsome bastard. You know, like, oh, you look radiant. And I was like, damn, you know, yoga makes a difference. Yoga really affected how I see myself. I mean, truly, you know. And that's it, nothing else changed. I mean, maybe my circulation was better and my cheeks were rosier, but, you know, I nothing really probably visual had changed, but my feeling had changed about myself, and I thought, now that's cool.
Well, as long as you remember that both are total illusions.
I like it. Yeah, it's great. That's the next step. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. All right, we're almost at the end of the show. There's a lovely picture of Hanuman, the monkey god, and I got to share with the audience that when I was going through a real difficult time at the church, we had some split going on. I used the image of Hanuman for, I think, 2 or 3 years, and I wore it on my neck, and it was very powerful for me, because Lord Hanuman was the monkey god, but he was the symbol of devotion, you know, and amazing strength and power. He was totally devoted to the god Rama. So it's that part of us that remains devoted no matter what. And I needed his strength at that time. And I was in India, and we happened to be in a Hanuman temple. There were hundreds of statues of Hanuman all the way down this hill that led up and down from the temple. And as I was walking down the hill, my Hanuman necklace broke and fell off. And it was like I completed that, you know. It was God telling me, I guess, at least that's the way I felt, that you passed the test, you know, you don't need that protection anymore. It's fine. But it was a powerful moment, you know, because it was like, thank you for all you've given me there, that strength and that energy. But now I can sort of internalize it. I don't need Hanuman as an image outside of myself. I can be that within. So, you know, I think that's the idea that we have with these images, right? Eventually they become us. We're no longer out there. They're in us.
Yeah, that's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. I love that. And it reminds me of something we talked about before, as far as really like staying present and listening and watching and feeling what feels right and responding to that. Because you could have easily just said, oh my God, you know, Hanuman is on the ground. This is sacrilege. And you could have scooped it up and been really worried and fraught with anxiety around it. But you felt, and you felt like, oh, okay, this is correct. This is right. And I had that with the fire, actually. I was going through a bunch of boxes that the restoration company had set as a total loss, which means they're going to go to the, you know, the dump or whatever. And it was very sad and difficult, of course. And I saw in there some of my sacred objects. And at first I was just, you know, angry. Oh, this is so rude. How could the restoration company people do this? You know, this is so sacrilegious. And then I thought, oh, you know what? These items might be moving on. They, you know, they might have protected me. Maybe they've protected the house. They protected my family. And now they're moving along. You know, they say people who are really into crystals, they'll say that a crystal finds you when you need it and it leaves you when you're done. Mm-hmm. And I love that myth because it makes us a little bit less attached to, you know, if you have a crystal and it moves on, it's not that, you know, maybe it's not that someone stole it or that you lost it. Maybe it was just time. And I like that idea in general, you know.
Yeah, it's very nice. I can't believe how this show has rushed by, but here we are at the end of it. Let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Brian. Next week, Mark Nepo joins me and to talk about his book, Inside the Miracle, Enduring Illness, Approaching Wellness. So that should be interesting. And thanks for listening, folks. And thank you, Brian, for another great show and a really good book.
Thank you. Yes, so nice to be with you again. I enjoy it.
All right. Thanks for listening, folks. Take care. Have a good one. Have a happy 4th. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.